ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. Welcome to The Money. This music that you're hearing now is about to do something. This bit could almost be the start of a supermarket commercial for Easter. Long weekend, lot of food, a lot of food. And more than anything else, chocolate, which turns out to be important, very important, for retailers.
Retailers think about winter and summer, and in the winter season, Easter is the most important event.
Paul Zara is the chief executive of the Australian Retailers Association.
So for a chocolatier, particularly a boutique chocolatier, you could be up to 70% of their profit over the Easter period. So it's really important. For a large chocolate company, it would be more likely to be about 25%, about a quarter of their profit. So it doesn't matter which way you look at it, it's still important from a trading perspective.
Tina Angelides is a chocolatier. She and her sister run Adora Handmade Chocolates. I caught up with Tina at their Newtown store.
Easter's super important. It's one of our peaks of the year that we look forward to, not only financially, but also it's quite an exciting year where we, a part of the year where we do our Easter bunnies and our little mini eggs. We're renowned for our spotty eggs. So it's our signature Easter range that we do from four different sizes of a mini, medium, dino eggs, we call them as well. So it's a bit of fun as well.
So when do you start planning for it?
Christmas Eve, to be perfectly honest. Start planning for our list come up on the board, and we talk about Easter, just the week of Christmas.
And when do customers start thinking about it?
I think customers this year in particular aren't thinking about it at all until the very last minute. I think people are always surprised when Easter comes in, because Easter came in to our stores straight after Valentine's Day. So a week after Valentine's Day, Easter came in into stores, and the comments were, oh my goodness, it's Easter already. I think everyone's always, year after year, gets surprised how quickly Easter comes.
Easter is early this year, and Tina's noticing.
Easter and Christmas is pretty on par for us. I would say, yeah, equal to each other.
So you need a good Easter,
yes.
Or you don't have a good year.
That's correct. Easter is super important because the lull months of, you know, June, July, August. So you need the Easter in order to wave over that quieter months.
I didn't know you had quieter months in winter. Why do you think that is?
People eat more, but there's no big celebrations for people to go out and buy things unless it's a birthday or an anniversary as such. So Easter tends to ride through that sort of quieter. People do eat more though, so our cakes do tend to sell quite well during that period. Our hot chocolates is always our biggest seller. So definitely winter for those sort of things, but the big item ticket numbers of Christmas and Easter, it only comes at those two times of the year.
How much are we talking about spending?
So we did work with Roy Morgan. Our research tells us that Australians will spend about $2 billion on Easter eggs and treats. So it is big business. Like it is certainly significant. But when we think about Easter, it's predominantly a sort of a festive food fair. So, you know, a chocolate particularly is the winner. But of course, it goes beyond that. Hot cross buns are also popular and other Easter treats.
This is a sidebar, Paul. But what is it with the hot cross buns in the shops in January?
I love this question because the retailer in me explains it from a logistic point of view. Because if you just think about it, you know, there's often a whole aisle dedicated to Christmas-related merchandise in a supermarket. So logistically, it's actually easier for the supermarkets, particularly or a department store for that matter, as they're selling down Christmas merchandise, is to bring in the next seasonal program, which is Easter. So it means that they don't have to relay the whole shop floor to bring in the new merchandise. So logistically makes sense. But from a consumer's point of view, of course, we don't put things into shops that people don't buy, and hot cross buns are a winner year round.
I know.
And the variants are becoming huge. So we see sort of seeing Vegemite hot cross buns and chocolate ones and hundreds and thousands. You're shaking your head.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head. I think you can eat hot cross buns in the 2 or 3 weeks leading up to Easter, and that's it. That's what I think. But what it doesn't explain, actually, is that we don't see Easter eggs, Easter chocolate, when we see the hot cross buns. They come later.
that they do come later, and that's partly because Easter can't be delivered in really hot temperatures. So it really relies on the weather to cool down. And in fact, there's a real formula for retailers. An early Easter is not a great Easter from a trading performance perspective, as in, because you know how Easter moves around. The later Easter is, the better. Now, that the reason why that occurs is because later in the year becomes colder and cooler. So this year, it actually is an early Easter. So whilst we're predicting $2 billion will be spent, it's about $400 million than last year. Most of that additional trading performance is coming from the additional population in the country rather than people spending more.
The weather turns out to be really important.
With Easter, the longer the runway into the actual Easter event, the better it is for retailers. And simply put, consumers, when they're buying chocolate, they're very conscious when they're transporting that back home that it's in an environment where it doesn't melt. So the later the Easter, the colder the climate, it talks more to people wanting to shop on chocolate, but equally to transport it home.
So no retailer loves an early Easter, but the chocolatier is going to love it less than anybody else.
Well, that's true, because they've got, again, they need a longer runway to sell the product. And, you know, particularly around Easter eggs specifically, they are worthless post-Easter Sunday. Although they're still chocolate, people are less likely to buy them post the Easter event. So there is Greek Easter. So retailers do love it. Greek Easter follows usually a week or two later because they've got a second opportunity to sell those Easter eggs. So your Greek listeners would know this. They would never shop on Easter at full price. They'd wait for the eggs and so forth to be discounted. But that's the second part of it. But post that sort of main Easter event, Greek Easter, after that, the retailers will discount heavily to clear the merchandise as quickly as possible because it has a shelf life.
Dealing with an early Easter and a product that you really have to sell before the big day aren't the only challenges for chocolate retailers this year.
Easter's right around the corner, and along with hot cross buns, chocolate Easter eggs and Easter bunnies will be on many shopping lists this week. But with the skyrocketing costs of cocoa around the world, how much longer will Australians be able to afford the
debt? So we got a notice end of last year almost that our chocolate's going to be going up by 35%. Now, that's the biggest jump in my 30-year career, and it has made a huge impact on how we make the decisions moving forward. We've been able to lock in some prices of chocolate, and so we've been lucky enough to still have Easter at our old prices, but come after Easter, you're going to start seeing some price changes within our store. I've noticed other stores have already made those changes, and it's inevitable. It's not something that none of us, I'm sure, are wanting to do, but it's definitely something that is having to be done.
Did you see it coming, or has it been part of something that's taken longer, or what?
We've been talking about it for a couple of years. It wasn't a surprise at all. We knew it was coming. That's why I had locked it. We were lucky that we could push it out as far as we could, and our suppliers of 30 years were able to support that. But it's come to a point where they can't push it further and we can't push it further anymore.
So at some point after Easter...
I didn't want to do it for Easter. I think everyone's feeling the pinch at the moment. And I sort of said, no, let's absorb until Easter. Let everyone have, you know, the prices that we've got now for Easter. But after Easter, it will. A week after Easter, the prices start going up.
The issue here is the price of cocoa beans. Actually, the price of cocoa futures. It's gone up more than 100% in 2024 alone. It's tripled over the past year. Not that Tina's paying that price yet, not even her supplier will be, because when you use futures contracts, you can hedge. Pia Piggott is an analyst at Rabobank.
Cocoa is one of the major inputs in chocolate bars, and that's definitely one of their major costs in terms of the cost of goods. So because you can hedge out years in advance to limit their risk, producers of chocolate are going to be hedging the chocolate cost on those contracts.
So though we've seen a rise in chocolate prices, we haven't seen the full extent of the rise because they've hedged. They've bought a contract at a price before it went up.
Yeah, definitely. So this price that we're at now, which is at a historical high, isn't the price that 100% of the cocoa they're buying is at. So they've been able to manage some of that risk, and they've passed on some of the costs because there have been overall cost increases for cocoa as well as other cost increases, more so on the manufacturing side and energy costs, for example. But that's just one input that has been quite difficult.
Usually what happens when prices are high, and lately it's been stratospheric, is that chocolate manufacturers buy less and rely more on what's in their inventory. But there's a problem.
The stocks have been depleting over the past few years because we're going into our third consecutive deficit. So that's definitely weighing on cocoa importers and producers of chocolate as well. We're currently sitting at about a stock to sales ratio of 27%, and that's very low. For the past decade, it's really been over 30% for the majority of that decade. So the stocks are declining because of those deficits, and that's weighing on the price as well.
What this all comes back to is the cocoa crop. Most of the world's supply is grown in just two countries, the Côte d'Ivoire, which is essentially the cocoa superpower, and its West African neighbour, Ghana. There have been 3 years of poor harvests, and a fourth one is expected. There are several reasons for this, but it starts with the weather.
Adverse weather, so El Nino, that causes drying in West Africa, and the Ivory Coast and Ghana produce up to 60% of global cocoa. So they're very important. We've seen that the Harmattan winds are another weather event that happens in West Africa, and they cause drying out in the countries in West Africa as well.
They come off the Sahara, don't they?
Yes.
And they should just about have finished at this point, as I understand. They're a kind of seasonal thing.
Yeah, definitely. Besides that, there's also viruses and diseases such as the black pod disease and swollen shoot virus. And really what's difficult in this situation is because farmers are getting a fixed price by the government, particularly in the Ivory Coast and Ghana, because they're getting that fixed price, they're not able to afford fertilizers or enough fertilizers to boost production. And they're not able to, there's not enough incentive there to replant trees.
Aging trees is a bit of an issue here, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. That's another agricultural issue because it takes 4 to 5 years for a tree to reach that mature production stage. And these cocoa trees can live from or produce from anywhere 30 plus years. But as they do get older, they mature and the production capacity does decline. So aging trees, aging farmers also exiting out of the crop for more lucrative crops as well.
So essentially farmers need an incentive to plant trees, which they're not going to get a payout from for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's a problem at the moment?
Exactly. And so it's also replanting, but there's also limited area expansion capacity because of the EU deforestation regulation that's underway in the EU. So that's going to limit expansion capacity. So it's really more so on the replanting side that there could be production expansion potential, but there's limited incentive for growers to do that.
All of that explains most of the poor harvest, so the supply. What about the demand?
So we've seen that demand for cocoa has remained relatively stable. Grindings are slightly down, but they're still above production for the past 3 years. So even though prices of chocolate have increased slightly, not as much as cocoa, we haven't seen a demand pull down because of the high prices.
Can I just get you to explain what grindings are? Because most people will think, oh, grindings.
Yeah, so the process from tree to chocolate, so there's the cacao tree and that has the cocoa pods on it. They're harvested, the cocoa pods are removed, fermented and roasted. Then those cocoa beans are either then exported for grinding into manufacturing chocolate or grinded and manufactured into chocolate in the producing states.
Demand is a bit down, actually, probably 5% this year. But production, supply, is down 10 or 12%. So you can see the problem. The net result is those astonishing increases in cocoa futures. And so far, much smaller increases in the price of chocolate, which for quite a while here in Australia were about the same as price rises for other foods. Now that other food inflation is moderating, chocolate is not. This is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy, and the price of chocolate is what we're looking at this time. You don't have to look hard at cocoa to realise that it's a very problematic crop. And this is underlined by the chocolate scorecard. It ranks the policies and practices of chocolate manufacturers, chocolate traders, chocolate brands, and chocolate retailers. John Dumais, who is a professor of accounting and finance at Macquarie University, is part of the scorecard's core team.
We look at how they perform on six different areas. So first one is traceability and transparency. So we want to know where the cocoa comes from, can actually identify the farms and the farmers who are producing the cocoa. And then if they can do that, they can actually deal with some of the other issues.
The first of these is living income.
So the farmers are generally paid not very much money for their cocoa, which is a systemic problem. The issue then is that the incomes that they get are generally very small. They live below the poverty line. They definitely live, most of them, below what we call a living income wage. And that's because the price of cocoa is low, or has been traditionally low. And the other reason is that the farmers themselves have very small farm holdings. So even if they want to grow more cocoa, there's not much more scope to grow because they don't have much land. So the typical farm is probably 3 or 4 hectares, and it will grow less than a ton of cocoa per hectare.
Despite the record high prices for cocoa, the farmers will see very little of that. In both Ghana and the Côte d'Ivoire, the government sets the price. Not making a living income connects to another problem, child labour.
Now, when we talk about child labour, we're not necessarily talking about kids, you know, just helping out doing a few chores on the farm. We're actually talking about kids doing work that adults should be doing. So we're talking about the pruning, the harvesting, we're talking about agrochemical spraying. You know, these are jobs that adults should be doing. And the kids have to work on the farm, otherwise the work doesn't get done. And in many of those cases, the kids aren't getting a proper education, so they don't have enough time to go to school and so forth.
Another concern is the overuse of chemicals.
Agrochemicals are needed because in monoculture you have a lot of insects, bugs. There actually is a problem with the mealybug, which is like an ant insect that burrows in and lays its larvae into the trees and kills them. So they want to protect against that. Also fungus and rot and that type of thing on the plants. So they're trying to protect the plants the best they can using agrochemicals. At the moment, because of El Nino and lack of rainfall, the plants are more susceptible to pests and pestilence, so therefore they're using more agrochemicals at the same time.
Then there's deforestation.
In order for the farmers to grow more cocoa, we have a monoculture system generally. So the trees are getting older, the ground is getting more dilapidated, minerals are going out of the ground. So therefore the easiest way sometimes to grow more cocoa is to go into the protected forests or new forested areas, chop down the trees, burn them, and plant cocoa because the soil is much more rich and it's much easier to get that up and running again.
This is one of the problems being targeted by the EU, which makes it the responsibility of chocolate manufacturers to get this right.
The EU Deforestation Directive is saying that in December of 2024, you have to prove that your cocoa is not coming from a deforested area or protected forest. If that is the case, or if you breach that directive, a company can be fined up to 5% of its worldwide turnover. So it's a very, very important issue. We were in Amsterdam just recently at a cocoa conference, and that was the big issue that everybody was worried about. Some of the bigger players probably have it under control because they have the time and the resources to do that, but a lot of the smaller players in the industry are very worried about it. So there's a bit of a impending crisis going on there.
This directive is well-intentioned. It seems like a good idea. But so far, its unintended consequence is to squeeze the farmers.
The farmers had a meeting about it late last year or April last year, and they're going, it's fine, we're happy to comply, but who's going to pay us the extra money? Yeah, the directive didn't come with any extra money attached to it, and that's one of the problems. The farmers themselves, they have very little power over the price they're getting because the government of Ghana and the government of Côte d'Ivoire, they are actually regulating what they call the farm gate price. Mm-hmm. So basically, cocoa is sold in the future. So chocolate companies who are producing now basically bought that cocoa in, say, 2022 under a contract. And in country like Ghana, it all has to be sold through the Cocoa Board, which is the government agency that actually controls the sale and export of cocoa internationally. So the farmers are getting what they're told they should be getting. They are not competing in the open market for the pricing.
This is a point worth underlining. They're not seeing anything of this.
And the worst news for Easter is that the hot cocoa price is showing no signs of cooling. Last night it jumped another 7.9%, and cocoa now costs quite a lot more than copper. Here's another graph of the price of cocoa, and it really is something, isn't it? Whenever you see something go vertical upwards like that, it's usually the precursor to it going vertical downwards.
And although that skyrocketing price of cocoa futures will have an impact on chocolate prices, we'll get to that shortly, it won't be as much as you might think.
The reality is that the ingredient cocoa in our chocolate bars isn't actually a very big cost when we have a look at the overall value of a bar of chocolate. The latest figures I've got, which were produced in conjunction with the EU, is about 37% of all the value in the value chain is with retailers. So people go to your grocery store, buy it.
Yeah.
They're making 37% of the income. Then you have the producers, you know, like your Hershey's, you know, Nestle and so Cadbury's. They're making 37% as well. And then you have the grinders who are making a small portion, and then you actually have the farmers who are making a small portion as
well. So those two are sharing about a quarter of what it is.
Yeah.
If we go back, John, to the chocolate scorecard, latest edition just out, are things getting better?
We're seeing improvements in traceability, for example, but that's also part of a necessity. I mean, the EU regulation says you need to be able to trace where your cocoa comes from. So it's now almost a fait accompli that if you're not doing that, you're not actually going to be complying with the legislation and you could have a bigger business risk. We're seeing improvements, some improvements in living income. We're seeing some improvements, especially in child labor, because a lot of the companies now, it's a very kind of political issue as well. And it's a very visible issue that's been around for quite some time. So we're actually seeing more companies working on not only just identifying child labor, what we call child labor remediation schemes.
This starts to bump into the modern slavery laws,
doesn't
it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we've just had the EU due diligence directive being passed, from what I understand. So that's about human rights. So you've got to be able to show that you're actually addressing human rights in your supply chain. So what we're doing, I think, is not only in the cocoa industry, but in many other different industries where raw materials, where the global north buys from the global south, so to speak, we are seeing a shift to give them more responsibility back to the companies to say, you have an obligation to know exactly where everything comes from and to ensure that the people who are producing it are not being disadvantaged and you're producing it under, you know, ethical or more sustainable methodologies.
This concern for sustainability is something that customers at high-end chocolate retailers value as well. Tina Angelidis at Adora.
We're all about the environment and sustainability, but we use Calibre. So Calibre has, if you go on their website about Calibre, they talk all about ethical sourcing. Each of our bags that come in are traceable, so you know exactly where they're coming from. They're not single origin, but you do see where they can all be traced from. So Calibre has a very strong stance on ethical sourcing, and that's why we do stick with Calibre, and we have stuck with Calibre for the last 30 years for that reason. We know where it's coming from.
The EU's requirements on human rights due diligence, on deforestation, on traceability, are having an increased impact on how cocoa is harvested. But making the industry more sustainable and fairer to farmers is what's known as a wicked problem.
So wicked problems are these kind of problems that you have that lots of people are trying to address the issues, but we don't have the right answers. So it's much more complicated than we think. So the moving parts, if you pay somebody more money, then what happens is they have more money available for their living needs. And what happens? The local suppliers then put up the prices because they need more money too. So that is part of the problem. And how do you actually make that solution? For example, another argument is, well, we just should pay the farmer more money for their cocoa. However, the argument is also if you pay more money for the cocoa, then generally it benefits only those farmers who have more production, not necessarily the people who are on the very, very small farm holdings, who in essence may be not economical at all under any circumstances. But how do you structurally change that when that's actually been part of their economy, part of their culture for nearly 100 years?
For most of us, chocolate is a treat, but it's quite a resilient one because it's not expensive. It's an affordable luxury. Paul Zara from the Retailers Association.
That's the best way to describe it. So even though what we are saying from our research is that people are spending about the same, slightly less, but they're not saying they're not going to spend at all. So they're still treating themselves. And that's the beauty about chocolate. It is seen as a luxury. Most people like chocolate. It's very few. You come across people that don't like chocolate. And if they do, it's because they've generally got an allergy. But they see it as a way to treat themselves, to treat others. And there's obviously a price range that's very wide and varied that allows people to shop on any budget.
If you want to take into account where your chocolate comes from and how it's produced, what does the chocolate scorecard tell you?
Companies like Tony's Chocolonely, which is a Dutch company whose business morality is about reducing or eliminating child labour and slavery in their supply chain. So their motto is really to have slave-free chocolate. There's another company called Ritter Sport, which has done really well this year. So we've given them recognition. We've given Tony's recognition because they're consistently good at what they do. And I guess a company that's more local, that's doing reasonably well, is Whittaker's out of New Zealand. So the problem that we have, though, is there's a fairly limited supply of that those products here in Australia. So you can buy Tony's in Australia. I think you can buy some Ritter's somewhere. And I know you can buy...
You can get Whittaker's.
You can get Whittaker's,
I speak
sure.
as an addict.
There you go. Yeah. but that's part of the problem. And reality is we have something that's a commodity. You know, go to the supermarket and it's there.
Super easy to get
yeah.
from a company that would be down towards the bottom of your list.
Super easy to get from some companies that are down towards the bottom. Super easy to get for some who are starting to improve and hit the middle ground. So I think that's really important to have a look at.
You will pay more for the brands that are doing more of the right things. But you're already paying more for all chocolate. The increasing price of cocoa beans has seen to that. Pia Pigott.
We're seeing two responses in terms of these higher cocoa prices. One is inflation or increasing the price of your chocolate bar, and two is shrinkflation. And that's where the price stays the same, but the volume decreases. So the unit value actually increases, and that is an increased cost for consumers, or they're not getting the same value that they once did.
And that will not be changing, not for the next year or so anyway. In fact, it's going to get worse.
We're expecting that for chocolate, at retail chocolate, everyday chocolate, that's going to continue to see quite significant levels of inflation just because the cocoa price continues to skyrocket. And that is going to weigh on producers' costs and margins.
So that EU deforestation legislation, which is so important in the effect it's having on the ground in West Africa, is that something we feel here?
We expect that over the next few years we will feel the effect, because we actually do import a lot of chocolate from Europe. So 35% of global cocoa grindings come from Europe. So they're a major producer of chocolate. That EU deforestation regulation will weigh on the price of cocoa globally and in Australia.
So it's another thing that's feeding into pushing up that price.
Definitely over the long term.
Thanks to Pia Pigott from Rabobank, John Dumais from Macquarie University, Paul Zara from the Australian Retailers Association, and Tina Angelidis at Adora Handmade Chocolates. The money comes to you from Gadigal Land, Sydney. It's produced by Whitney Fitzsimmons. Our sound engineer is Beth Stewart. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.